okay. You can be the boonies. That's okay. This is the boonies, isn't it?
Yeah. Hi there. The House Transportation Committee will come to order and welcome everybody. I don't know how many times you've sat through this presentation, but maybe we'll have some new interesting information. So with that, I am going to go ahead and open an informational hearing on the status of the Columbia River Crossing Project. And I'm going to go ahead and ask Representative Kotek to come up.
I'm your new thing. Mm-hmm. I'm going to make it interesting.
Good. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland. Thank you for the opportunity to speak before you today about the Columbia River Crossing. And I am trying to be new to lighten up, but I do think you're going to hear the status of the project. You know, things have changed since your last presentation, I think, in a very positive way. So I think you're going to appreciate the presentation today. You should have my testimony. I am going to read it in for the record because I do think it's important. The Columbia River Crossing is a transportation project of national, state, and local significance. This project is not just about a bridge. The CRC encompasses 5 miles of critical transportation infrastructure, connecting Oregon and Washington, including 2 bridges and 7 major interchanges. When we complete this project, we will significantly address the serious safety, congestion, and freight mobility issues plaguing the corridor, while also vastly improving public transportation connectivity and bike and pedestrian mobility. The Oregon side of the CRC is anchored in my district, in House District 44, clearly very important for the folks where I live. Beyond the clear regional impacts of this project, its footprint is of special interest to the residents of my district who are affected daily by the current congestion, safety, and connectivity problems that the CRC project aims to resolve. The project is a common topic of conversation in North Portland. In fact, what I get asked when I talk about this is, when are we going to start building? That's the question I get asked. When are we going to stop talking, and when are we going to start doing? My constituents anticipate and need tangible improvements to how they get around, the quality of the air they breathe, and their general quality of life. From an economic perspective, the CRC is a win-win. The project will sustain 27,000 jobs, creating 16,000 direct construction jobs, and supporting 11,000 jobs indirectly in the rest of the local economy. Clearly, this would be a much-needed boost as we emerge from this economic recession over the next several years. The stifling effect of the current congestion problems in the corridor will be lifted, enabling the Port of Portland and the Port of Vancouver, not to mention the hundreds of businesses in the Columbia Corridor, to thrive and expand, thereby fueling a more prosperous Oregon. I would be supporting this project for these reasons alone if I didn't live there. But I do live there, and I've attended numerous open houses and community meetings on this process, and I anticipate going to very many more. My neighbors and our neighborhoods will bear the brunt of the upheaval that comes with the construction of a project of this magnitude. In the end, though, a myriad of livability concerns will disappear. Accidents will substantially decrease. We will have light rail to Vancouver. We will be able to bike or walk safely across the waterways. Air quality will improve simply because cars and trucks won't be stalled in traffic for hours on end. Getting home from work in the afternoon will not be the nightmare that it is today. The tangible positive impacts in my district are many. The Bridgeton and East Columbia neighborhoods, which lie just east of I-5 as you're heading north, are looking forward to a safer Marine Drive interchange and improved bike pedestrian connectivity. The Port of Portland has also been focused on improving the Marine Drive interchange as it provides access to the Rivergate Industrial District and several deep raft marine terminals. The residents of Hayden Island, who live in the shadow of 2 bridges integral to this project, and there are two, there's the North Portland Harbor Bridge and the bridge across the Columbia, they will see the most changes. Residents of the island can only access mainland Portland by getting on the freeway and driving south over the North Portland Harbor Bridge. This makes leaving or coming back to the island during commute times nearly impossible. Not to mention the complete standstill that happens when the bridge is up, or if there's an accident, which is very often. There is some back bus access right now on Hayden Island, but the addition of light rail and bike pedestrian connections will be a huge boon to the economy on the island. That being said, I need to stand up for the residents on Hayden Island who are reeling a bit by changes that are going to be discussed today about that impact on the livability on the island. The proposed cost refinements, specifically the retention of the current North Portland Harbor Bridge, have the potential to wreak havoc on the livability of that neighborhood there on the island. They've recently completed a neighborhood plan that they're going to have to adjust because of the changes that are being proposed. While the CRC plans to improve local connectivity on the island, which is a good thing, the size and scope of the Ring Road interchange, placement of stormwater management facilities, and the design of the North Tomahawk Connector still need to be improved to meet resident satisfaction. I look forward to working with the CRC team and ODOT to make those things happen so we can really build the project but also maintain the livability on that island. It's a very large project. There's been lots of controversy. There will continue to be contentious discussions in many quarters, but we need to get it right and we need to keep going forward. We have that window of opportunity around funding that we need to seize, and like my residents ask, when are we going to get started? When are we going to start going on this? All the savings that you're going to hear today about in terms of cost refinement are reflective of concerns that have been brought up by community activists. The highway portion of the project will be reduced by 20%, but we're going to hopefully maintain, we'll be maintaining the light rail, the bike ped facilities, and the critical light rail connection. So we're going to get 90% of what we need around safety and congestion and transit for about 75% of the cost. That's the way I'm looking at it now, and you'll see that cost refinement proposal later. I want to thank the CRC team for working really hard to come up with those changes. It has not been easy, but I think it's a good proposal. Finally, we need to do tolling on this bridge. I'm very supportive of that. Tolls will help consolidate riders and encourage people to use public transportation, as well as guarantee the local revenue necessary to support this project. I support, personally, pre-construction tolling. I also think we need to do tolling on I-205. It's going to be up to us, together, legislatively, local leaders, also working with our colleagues in Washington State, to make sure the tolling happens. We need to have that as part of the financing package for this project, and I'm committed to doing that. I hope you are, too. I think I'll conclude there and just say thank you for the opportunity. I look forward to working with you on this project. It's incredibly important for the state, the country, and my district, and I really appreciate the time today. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
I don't see any.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Okay, I'm going to ask for Director Matt Garrett and Secretary of Transportation Paula Hammond from Washington State Department of Transportation, and then Richard Brandman, who is the ODOT Project Director. So welcome, and thank you very much for coming. Good addition to the discussion.
Madam Chair, I appreciate you offering this opportunity for the record. Matthew Garrett, Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. And before I begin, I'm not sure I can deliver the message any more eloquently than Representative Kotek did. She was spot on in the opportunities that will be brought forth by this project and some of the challenges that we face as we continue to breathe life into this great opportunity. But again, Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's certainly a pleasure for us to tell what I think is a very good story, not only for the state of Oregon, for the state of Washington, for the West Coast, but for the nation. That's what this is all about. This Columbia River Crossing project, I believe, is a one-of-a-kind type project. And as you look across the country, you will not see anything like it. It is a project that has many moving parts. It's about the highway. It's about the bridge. It's about light rail, bike ped opportunities. It's about seven interchanges on the Oregon-Washington side that we need to deal with. It's about connecting two cities. It's about connecting two states, and it's about connecting two countries, and it's going to eliminate a bridge lift, a stop sign in the middle of the I-5 transportation trade corridor. Just makes sense. We have great opportunities here. The bottom line is this is truly a partnership defined in the most broad terms between the state of Washington, the state of Oregon, between the Oregon Department of Transportation and the Washington Department of Transportation, and the various communities that align themselves along the bridge influence area, that five and a half mile area from about Columbia Boulevard to SR 500 up in the state of Washington. I'm also honored today to introduce Paula Hammond, who is the Secretary of the Washington Department of Transportation. She's been the Secretary up there for about 2 years. She has been with WashDOT for, I think, 29 plus years, obviously starting very early when she was in grade school. significant challenges. And what's interesting is we have conversations as DOTs. Literally, the challenges are the same. You could literally just insert Oregon or Washington into the mix of challenges that we face. But Paula is a very special individual. State of Washington is fortunate to have her running the Department of Transportation. I will tell you that she's recognized on a national level. She was just awarded by the Association of State Transportation and Highway Officials with the President's Award for her work in the areas of climate change, leadership in terms of communication, clear and crisp communication. Is a signature of Paula Hammond. And she's just a leader within our organization on the myriad of national issues that come before us. So we're fortunate to have this type of partner across the bridge engaged in this significant project. Probably most importantly, she has roots in Oregon. She is a Klamath Falls girl. Grew up there, came up to Oregon State University, graduated there as a professional engineer. So again, the roots of Oregon are attached very tightly to this project. What we're going to do today is kind of run three abreast here. I will share a context, an overview of where we have been with this project. Then turn the attention to Secretary Hammond, who will speak to some of the best practices, some of the lessons we tried to learn as we engaged this project. We wanted to make sure we did it right. And then we'll turn it to Mr. Brandman, who will speak to where we're going, how we are trying to make this project a reality for both our states. So we're good with the PowerPoint here. I'm not a PowerPoint guy, so I go a little fast. So Paula's going to try to keep up with me. The bottom line here, this is a conversation that's been a decade in the making, to be very honest with you, going back to the 1999-2000 timeframes, and then formally engaging this conversation in 2001-2002, when then Governor Locke and Governor Kitzhaber brought civic leaders, business leaders, to say, tell me what the issues are in this corridor. And they did indeed identify issues. They identified three, as a matter of fact, saying, listen, we are disadvantaging our businesses here in the state of Oregon and Washington. Now, you've got a huge transportation deficit here. You need to correct at least three things. And they identified those three projects. And I'm happy to say, on the Washington side, the Salmon Creek project is done. On the Oregon side, we are now engaged in the Delta Park project. The final project they identified as a solution to these transportation challenges is the Columbia River crossing. From that effort grew a greater task force, a 39-member task force that engaged the issue from about 2005 to 2008. 39 folks representing both sides of the river, representing the breadth and depth of transportation community interest specific to this. They identified the challenges, again, building on the work of this business and civic group that Governors Locke and Kitzhaber put together. Looking at evaluation criteria, how do we continue to refine and move toward a solution here? And looking at different alternative concepts for the solution. I will tell you, we began with roughly 30 different alternatives. We looked at everything. The process, the discipline we're engaged in now has us arriving at what we think is the appropriate solution. So, again, what problems? They identified six problems, and the task force did. Congestion, public transit, bicycle pedestrian-type issues, freight mobility, seismic issues, and safety. We have been before your colleagues before articulating these challenges. This is nothing new. We have tried to make sure that you understood where we were in this conversation. We've been before you and your colleagues going back to 2002 when we, again, put on the table, listen, we have a corridor that now has about 135,000 folks traveling across it on a daily basis. As we forecast out to the 2030 timeline, we see that growing to 184,000 or more folks using that. That's just basic background growth where we are going. significant to that is the congestion that it brings with it. There is a cost of inaction here. We have peaks now in the morning, in the afternoon, that's where the congestion is. But in between those peaks now, freight can navigate through, commerce can move, and they use that in a surgical sense to drive and deliver their product to market during those times. If we don't animate this opportunity, we see those peaks increasing to roughly 15 hours, which will deny, again, freight's ability to move, which will deny, I think, and create another disadvantage for Oregon and Washington businesses. I don't think we can allow that. So congestion, obviously one of the significant issues we will address. Public transit, we have a deficit there. We don't have a good public transit system. We roughly carry about 3,500 riders a day. With this investment, we see roughly 18,000 a day, given the option to use transit to migrate to and fro. The bike pedestrian facilities are just plain lousy. They're dangerous, to be very honest with you. We have an on and off again opportunity there, 4-foot paths. Again, we will grow the opportunities, giving folks the options to bike or walk to the various destinations. Speak a little bit more about freight mobility. Some fast facts. Today, roughly $40 billion worth of freight crosses the bridges, and we look to the future again, that 2030 timeframe. We see that growing to about $71 billion. The economic implications and opportunities cannot be overstated with this bridge. Again, as we look to the future and we look at freight volumes, we do see a tsunami of freight coming at us. Again, even in these bad economic times, we'll get through it, we'll survive, but we'll start to thrive and we'll see that freight grow. That freight inevitably, or at least 3/4 of the freight, will continue to move by trucks. What's important is roughly 3/4 or 75% of all the activities of movement within the 5.5 miles of this bridge influence area, they're getting on and off to the various transportation infrastructure, to the various economic opportunities that reside within the bridge influence area, led by the two ports, Portland and Vancouver. So again, a lot of movement on and off within that small period of time. Going to flip to seismic or earthquake risk. Safety is obviously a golden thread woven deeply into this patchwork quilt of opportunity with the Columbia River and crossing. I would remind you that there are two bridges at the Interstate Bridge, one built in 1917, the other built in 1958. They obviously do not meet the current seismic standards. The bottom line is we have armored up the I-5 corridor with our ATIA investments, where those bridges that we replaced now meet those seismic retrofits. We've got another one to do in the Columbia River crossing. We have major concerns, and we know we have a deficit just where the timber, the foundations are built on timber pilings. Again, a good shake may take this thing down. We have our towers braced up with steel braces to make sure that they hold together. We can do better with that. We know the existing infrastructure is not capable of handling a good shake that may come our way. The issue of safety, again, this stretch of corridor is the highest crash location on I-5 in the state of Oregon. It's twice what similar urban highways deliver. So we see now about a crash a day, roughly 350 a year. As we project out, if we do nothing, we see that doubling, or 80% or so. So you're talking about 700 or so crashes moving in this quarter. Now, again, there are economic implications to that. There's human suffering, the toll that, obviously, we could put a number on that as well. There's also environmental type issues. As you queue things up, you're not only stuck in traffic, can't move yourself or your product to market, but also you're spitting emissions into the atmosphere. So again, we will continue to work on these safety type issues when we correct this facility. I guess put simply, the Columbia River crossing is a long-term comprehensive solution. It will replace the bridges. It will bring light rail to Clark College in Vancouver. We will improve bicycle and pedestrian opportunities. We will work on freight at Marine Drive to improve the operations and functionality in that facility. And we will, again, remove what now are very tightly close-spaced interchanges that create safety and operational issues. We will clean that up as well. Congestion, we will eliminate the bridge lift. We will meet the seismic standards of today, safety woven through that. We will, again, double the commute options for folks with transit investment. We will increase the opportunities with bike ped accessibility to that opportunity, again, which increases safety as well. Significant and substantial improvements at Marine Drive, freight mobility, economic opportunity will grow from that. And again, we will make sure that that movement and that bridge corridor is as crisp and safe as possible. The benefits are many. There's no question you can look at this, the opportunities it brings in terms of economic revitalization, community revitalization, the issues of safety, the environmental issues, as I said, the operational issues, and the multimodal nature of this project does indeed make this unique. We will work very hard to continue to advance this project to meet those opportunities. There's another opportunity that I would be remiss if I didn't state. This is about jobs as well. Here is a project that, if we make an investment, brings as many as 20,000 jobs. And that's just hardcore boots on the ground working on the bridge, direct, indirect. But the collateral benefits of the investment, the development of the communities, which will attract new businesses, new business opportunities, new jobs to the areas. It will be a gift that keeps on giving. There is no question in my mind. So with that, what I want to do now is pass the baton to Secretary Hammond, where she will speak to the best practices. Again, we tried to go to school on projects of similar types, but again, nothing unique here. This is not an apples-to-apples comparison. But we wanted to make sure that when we arrived at our solution, that it was comprehensive. We'd gone to school on other folks' efforts, but we now stand at a point of we need to deliver this thing. So, Paula?
Thank you, Matt. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, happy to be here today. It's always nice to come home to Oregon, although as I came across the bridge last night, I met with a wreck at the end of the bridge on the Washington side, and it reminded me one more time about the vulnerability of that narrow facility and the need for us DOTs to continue to operate them well and make sure that we have facilities that are safe for our travelers. One of the things that, as Matt talked about, the importance of this corridor, not only to the Portland and Vancouver region, but to our two states and to the nation as we see it. This is a project that for Interstate 5, the West Coast corridor, is tremendously important for our national federal agencies to support. We are fortunate that last year, USDOT, both Federal Highways and Federal Transit, named this project as a project of national significance. What that means for us, we think, and we've seen some of the benefits already, is that no longer do you wait to produce a design and invite the federal agencies and the regulatory agencies to see what they think after you've got it partway designed, but you invite them in early. And with this kind of a designation, we have the commitment of the federal agencies for streamlined review of permitting, of applications, and things that we might need. Now, we hope some money comes with that, too, and we'll play up this designation every step of the way. But to have our federal agencies standing with us early, giving us their thoughts, buying into our designs and the appropriateness of how we're moving forward is really a boon for us. In our receiving our designation, national designation gives us the ability to demonstrate that this project can be a national model. Matt's talked about the fact that this is not just a highway bridge. It's a bridge that will carry both high-capacity transit and cars and trucks moving our freight in and out and through the region. We know that in these urban congested areas, the solution isn't just lane miles. For us, congestion relief is a three-part solution: to first remove choke points and bottlenecks, which this bridge definitely is. The second technique is to operate the system well, to manage your lanes, to manage your freeway, and to make the most use of the existing system that you have, and then to actively manage the traffic as you move through. The third is to provide options, and that's what this high-capacity transit light rail system will do for us, is give the opportunity for daily commuters to get out of their cars one or more days a week, have the ability not to have to drive, sit in traffic, and get a little bit of their lives back as they move forward. So we're working hard with our federal partners and other regulatory agencies who from the beginning are coming in to see how we're developing this project so that they can give us their ideas and their approval as we move on and get final permits as we move to the end of the NEPA document. We've also invited the Oregon and Washington tribal governments to participate with us early, tell us what they know about the history of this area. We know it's rich in cultural history, and to help us as we think about how to move this bridge forward, what kinds of things we'll have to consider and be ready for as we start to dig in the dirt. Washington State, about 2002, was beginning to look at some very big and high-cost projects in our state that we knew we needed to be on the top of our game for delivery, not only in the way that we estimated those projects, but how we delivered them and how we managed them, also in building credibility with the public so that they would continue to support the investments that we know our transportation system needs. We went around the country, a few of us, and looked at very carefully how other big projects were delivered. We looked at those that hadn't gone so well. You'll see one in Boston that's mentioned, and we looked at projects that did go well and were very successfully delivered, and we learned from those, and we asked people who were involved what worked, what didn't, and why did the project turn out the way it did. What we were looking for were best practices. We learned three critical things that are mandatory for every project to be successful, and we're adopting those. We've adopted those in Washington State and are applying those also on this bi-state project with Oregon. The first and most important thing is effective project management. How you manage day-to-day, not only what's happening on the delivery of the project, but how you manage risks that might be just around the corner. We know that the use of design build was, it, for us in 2002, it's kind of new, but it's a way to quickly deliver and have early contractor buy-in and expertise on your projects as projects are designed. So having the designers and the contractors together has really been a good way for us in Washington to deliver projects, and we're doing more and more of that, and expect this project will be the same kind of a delivery model. So the other things we learned was that communications was critical to a successful delivery of a project, which is why we started so early on this project. The project sometimes has a feeling that it's gone on forever. People stop listening. The noise kind of just goes on and on. But we're trying to, as we get closer and closer to our final design concept, nearing the end of our EIS, Environmental Impact Statement, as we get towards Record of Decision, and then truly need your help, Washington legislators' help, the citizens' buy-in to tolling, and our federal delegation for federal money, we need everyone to feel positive about this project. So we don't feel like we can communicate enough, and we will continue to offer any kind of public involvement and engagement with the legislatures as we need. We learned, too, on projects that only the owner can be the owner. To turn over or delegate the delivery of a project to a consultant or a third party, not that there's anything wrong with consultants, but when the owner that has the public trust of the control of the funding is not present in decision-making, sometimes things go awry. And that's why with ODOT and WashDOT, as we have co-developed this team, we sit together in a project team office, we have our consultants sitting together, and this is a co-managed team that really will help the ownership and the control of the project stay on track. The other thing that we looked at in some of the areas of project delivery were the importance of the environmental and permitting agencies to be upfront with you in the beginning to help you learn and understand what concerns they may have so that you can maneuver around those and mitigate and avoid where you can with environmental impacts. I mentioned some of these things. I think the last thing that I would mention here is scope and budget tracking. It's very easy for a scope of a project to grow and grow as people think of new things to add to the project to solve other problems in the nearby area. That's the kind of thing you have to have control of in your project management, and you have to know what you're building when you start your project. You have to have a clear scope, a clear concept, and price. And price is where we have worked very hard on making sure that as we look at cost estimating, the way we maintain and build credibility with the public and with decision makers is that we come in on budget and we deliver the project on time. So the technique that we use in Washington and are using on this project is what we call cost risk estimating. And it has a jargon term called CVIP, cost estimate validation process. But it's essentially a base estimate that's developed for the project as if the project was to go perfectly well with nothing coming up that you didn't expect. We then look for all of the risks that might come into the project. It could be a utility issue. It could be a tribal cultural find. It could be labor disruption. It could be unforeseen materials underground, and the list goes on and on. And we estimate what that financial impact might be to the project if it were to happen. Once you get all of your risks identified, it helps you manage your project so that you are watching for those things, but it also helps you estimate if some of those things reasonably were to happen, how you might add those into your cost estimate for the project. You hear oftentimes that projects, big projects especially, come in 30, 40, 50, 100% over the original estimate. I would bet it's because folks discounted or didn't think about the risks they might encounter and didn't take that into consideration as they put their range of their project costs together. So we're getting better at that in Washington State and are definitely using that in our process here on this Columbia River Crossing project. Our communications effort, we think, has been a good one. We have had over 21,000 contacts at over 700 events, and if this project goes on much longer, that list will grow. But for our EIS, the draft is out. We've had over 1,600 comments. We are on never ending in our public involvement and our opportunity for advisory groups and other kinds of community outreach, and offer those even to still today. So we are continuing to go out to groups who ask us to come, work with them, talk to them about the impacts in their own neighborhoods. The other important thing for us is to be transparent in how we're delivering the projects, the risks that we're thinking about or seeing or looking at, and some of the impacts and maybe issues or hurdles that we're working on to try and overcome. So we want folks to be able to feel like they own this project, know this project, and understand how the progress is going every step of the way. As one part of that, we have now a Project Sponsors Council that the two governors have appointed, made up of citizen co-chairs. Thankfully, they came over from the task force. Henry Hewitt from Oregon and Hal Dengerink from Vancouver have continued to serve and should get some kind of a big reward at the end of this to help us guide through the decision-making process. The governors wanted this Project Sponsors Council, made up of the two cities, Portland and Vancouver, TriMet and CTRAN, the transit agencies, and then the regional planning organizations, as well as Matt and myself, to help guide some of the decision-making and thinking around how this big project can fit within the context of Portland and Vancouver. Each are different communities. Each have little cultural differences amongst themselves. They don't always agree on how things could look. I'm sure that surprises you. And we're working very carefully to make sure that this Project Sponsor Council, at the end of this design review, feels like they got a bridge that serves their community's needs, that fits the transportation and economic needs of their communities, and is something they can be proud of and feel like they had a part of in delivering a successful transportation project. So again, we see this as a national model. We feel nationally, as we look at other kinds of projects, no one else is putting their high-capacity transit and highway together on a transportation corridor in the way that we are. We're creating a citizen mobility council because this will be an actively managed, performance-based corridor. We're going to make sure that the safety elements, the safety performance reporting, the mobility, the throughput, the traffic reliability, all of those things continue to work smoothly on into the future. We don't just deliver a project anymore. We deliver a transportation system that's managed. And we feel this can be something that nationally other folks can look at and see the success once we build it and feel that it's really a wave of the future, which is why the federal government is so interested in this project. So at this point, I will turn the presentation over to Richard Brandman, who's our Oregon director for the project.
Thank you. It's a pleasure for me to be here today as well to talk with you about how can this project actually move forward. I think as you've probably paid attention to this project over the last several years, there's a lot of, I think, misperceptions about what the project actually is. So first, to just reiterate very briefly, The project is not just a bridge. It's encompassing 5.5 miles of improvements, including the bridge, and a couple of miles of roadway improvements on either side of the bridge, with improvements to basically seven tightly spaced interchanges that serve as the economic engines that get people on and off this facility to their destinations that are creating the economic activity. The reason why, and we get this question a lot, the reason why the interchanges are integral to this project is because those are the places that allow the economic activity to occur. Those are the places that allow the roadway users, the auto users of that bridge to get on and off. And they were constructed a long time ago in a manner that's not particularly safe. And there's very high volumes of cars getting and trucks and getting on and off of those interchanges. And so that's why the interchanges themselves are part of this project. Additionally, as you've already heard, there are bike and pedestrian improvements, light rail improvements, and certainly last but not least, major improvements of access to both the Port of Portland and the Port of Vancouver. We get a lot of questions about the cost and why does it cost so much. And it, in large part, is because of those elements that I just discussed. It's not just the bridge. It's all of those elements. It's a multimodal project that's 5 miles in scope. But we're also sensitive to what we're hearing, and we are trying to respond very diligently to the community as well as to our funding partners to try and ensure that we're going to deliver the best project at the lowest cost. And so that's been our goal all along. And as we move projects forward, you always do a number of things as projects move forward to try and reduce the cost of the project. You do things like value engineering. Is there a different way to design a bridge pier to save money? Are there ways you could look at just the total design of interchanges to save money? That's been going on repeatedly throughout the couple years of this project that has been in this design stage, and it's still ongoing. But additionally, we were asked by our Project Sponsors Council last June, could you actually think about rescoping some of the elements of the project? Are there things that you could defer, for example, from the initial construction period to try and bring the cost down? Or maybe there's portions of the freeway that you could reuse as opposed to tear out and rebuild. And so we've taken a hard look at that, and with the goal in mind of trying to ensure that the basic purpose and need of the project is not compromised, to make sure that safety is not compromised. We did conclude, however, that there were elements of the project that we could reuse, for example, or that there were elements of the project that could be deferred to some point down the road. Because as we do these analyses, we're looking at the long term here. And this is a bridge that's going to last a long time, as well as a facility that will last a long time. And a lot of the impacts that may occur don't occur on the opening of that bridge. They may occur 25, 30 years down the road. And so what we're doing is trying to design an initial project that's manageable from both the size and functionality and a financing perspective so that we're able to, when those additional elements are needed down the road, allow for them to come on at that particular point in time. So after about 5 months of doing this analysis, we have recommended to our Project Sponsors Council a package of cuts that encompass the things I just talked about, such as value engineering or reusing the North Portland Harbor Bridge or deferring some portions of some of the interchanges, with a sum total of reducing our project budget by $650 million, which is a rather significant reduction in the budget. It's over 20% of the roadway budget itself. Next logical question would be, so how are you going to pay for all this? And we've been working very diligently to move that question, answer that question, and come up with a very realistic funding plan. The funding plan itself is a three-legged stool. We're looking for funding from our federal partners, from the two states of Oregon and Washington, as well as from tolls. So let me start on the federal side. We are pursuing two different funding sources at the federal level. One is from the Federal Transit Administration. They have a They have a category of funds called New Starts, and we have a pretty aggressive request that will be going to the Federal Transit Administration, somewhere in the neighborhood of $750 to $800 million. And with the help of our congressional delegations, plural, both Oregon and Washington, led by Senator Murray and Congressman DeFazio, there's language in appropriations bills that are moving forward that are increasing the likelihoods of actually achieving that amount of funding. Secondly, we're pursuing through another source of funds called the Projects of National Significance, upwards of $400 million of federal funds to add to the project's revenue streams. And we're asking that sum of money through a committee that Congressman DeFazio is the chair of. As we move forward, we're advancing the conversation on tolls. This will be the first time in a long time that there would be tolls in the Portland-Vancouver metropolitan area. And we are right now analyzing a variety of concepts and talking about those concepts with the general public. But I will tell you that there is not really a way to put the project together without tolls, and we are anticipating more than $1 billion in toll revenue at the end of the day. Last, when our funding plans are finalized, well, actually when our designs are finalized, we still don't have a total consensus on the scope of the project, but we hope to have that in early December. When we have our mitigation plans in place, when our cost estimates are then finalized, we'll be able to come back and have a conversation with you about what's the extent of revenues that would be required from the two states. And before we come back, the two states will have the conversation to see how we might want to structure that conversation. As another example of ways that we're trying to save money, the bridge design that's moving forward is on the screen right now. And what's unique about this is that there were two structures crossing the Columbia River in this, you can't really see it on the slide, but there's a northbound and a southbound structure. Those would both be for all aspects of the project that's moving forward. We had previously considered three structures, one for autos northbound, one for autos southbound, and then one for the light rail. But we were able, through, I think, creative engineering, to conclude that we could actually put the light rail on the bottom decks of the southbound bridge and put the bicycle and pedestrian facilities on the bottom deck of a northbound bridge. So that has great advantage for us. It actually saves money. It saves piers in the water. It saves land on the riverbanks for either open space or some kind of development that the communities may desire. So we're pretty excited about the bridge design that's moving forward. It's cost effective. It's not extravagant by any means, and it will help us achieve our funding objectives. Last, I think you're all aware that we have a light rail system in the Portland region today. That stops right now in North Portland at the Expo Center, and the recommendation is to extend the light rail across the Columbia River, and first across Hayden Island, providing new access to Hayden Island, which it sorely needs, and then across the Columbia River through downtown Vancouver, terminating on a park and ride at Clark College. Last, what's the time frame for putting this all together? We are right now in the middle of concluding our final environmental impact statement. We hope to have that impact statement published sometime next summer in the June or July time frame. When that's published, it will be concluded with what's called a record of decision, which would allow us to move into final design and start construction in 2012 and end in 2018. So we're advancing this conversation. We feel we have a project that's very achievable. It's trying to respond to a lot of the community expectations that we have to both deliver a good project and deliver a good project at a reasonable cost. And so with that, I'd conclude my remarks, and I think we're all open to any questions you have.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple of questions, and Matt, I think it came during your part of the presentation. You mentioned earthquake risk. How many other bridges in Oregon do not meet seismic safety activities?
Chair Beyer, Representative Tomei, significant amount. As a matter of fact, we just came out with a research study that speaks to how vulnerable we are. If we get a big shake, and again, this research study was looking at a 0.8, 0.9 Cascadia subduction quake, we're vulnerable. We're exposed. So I can get you the specific numbers, but again, it's quite a few.
If I could just ask one more. Thank you. So you mentioned that the highest crash location on I-5, is that on the bridge itself, or is it
Chair Beyer, Representative Tomei, I'm speaking about that bridge influence area, that 5.5 mile
space
from Columbia Boulevard to SR 500 in Washington.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Call.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I want to thank you guys for coming in today. This has been very informative. And right off the bat, I want to applaud you guys for, exhibiting the fiscal restraint responsibility that this task has needed desperately. I know that the process, I think, put the directors both in kind of an unenviable situation where we were like, go plan a bridge, and then the price tag came back and we were all like, holy moly, that's the price of the bridge, you got to fix this. So you guys did a fantastic job on that, and for that I'm very grateful. My overarching concern right now is not about the design of the bridge. I'm actually becoming increasingly satisfied with where that is getting to and what the result will be. My concern is the variables on the other side of that bridge. For me, we don't have, as of yet, the capacity to build light rail in Vancouver, nor a commitment from the citizenry of Vancouver that that's what they want to do. We don't have, as of yet, anything firm about pre-construction tolling on the 5. We don't have, to my understanding, a firm commitment between the two states to move for an exception so that we can toll the I-205 span so that we can have something that approaches a smart and responsive congestion pricing regime moving traffic between the two states. And to my understanding, we don't have very thoughtful dialogue on land use policy beyond the metro area, including Vancouver and Clark County, into a regional discussion about how we're going to move forward. And it seems to me this bridge is part of, if not a major part of, how we are going to move forward as a two-state community that is inextricably dependent upon each other. And so what I'm wondering now, that I feel like the bridge, you know, qua bridge, you know, itself is not necessarily a concern for me. How do we start taking away some of these other concerns? How do we get to this point where we can say, look, we're going to address light rail, we're going to get the assurances we need, we're going to address pre-construction tolling, we're going to work tirelessly to get an exception so that we can toll the 205 span, and Vancouver and Clark County are going to be part of this broader bi-state community and work to effectuate smart land use policy so we're not in this boat again?
I'd like to address that. First of all, thank you, Chair Beyer, members. Let's start with the tolling. We are nearing completion of a tolling study. Our Washington State Legislature holds the authority for tolling facilities in Washington. In Oregon, the Transportation Commission has the authority to designate tolling on a corridor. So our legislature asked us to do a tolling analysis. First of all, not to come back with the exact price of the toll or to say exactly how it will happen early, after construction, etc., but to give them the scenarios by which they can make some decisions and understand how that will fit into a larger financial plan. So the kinds of analysis we've done is pre-construction tolling. By the way, they've given us authority in Washington State on SR 520 corridor. We'll do pre-construction tolling as early as late 2010. We'll be building the bridge. It will be open for traffic in 2014. And so you can imagine how that was an interesting public dialogue that people would start paying before the construction started. Anyway, that was part of the analysis here. We've looked at tolling both I-5 and 205, recognizing that it's much easier to get a federal interstate tolled if you're building a new bridge on that federal interstate. So far, we don't have a mechanism for approval by federal highways or USDOT to toll a transportation facility that is parallel to and not the one being improved. So there's a discussion that we have to have. Fortunately, we're already having that discussion in Washington. We have Interstate 90 and 520, which are parallel on Lake Washington.
So we're opening that door for this conversation if it should become the choice to toll 205 as well. We intend that these will be variably priced tolls, in other words, demand management type of tolls that will be higher in the peak periods and lesser throughout the day and in the middle of the night when the traffic is less, which will encourage some people to make different choices with their trips during the peak periods. We also have a huge hurdle, I agree, on getting the Clark County citizens to vote on the operations of light rail in Clark County, which is what they have to do. They have to vote to tax themselves to operate this facility in some sort of a joint arrangement, I would assume, with TriMet. And that's something we're beginning to work on. We would love encouragement and help from the Oregon side on having this go forward. Again, we talked about those cultural differences between our two states and even within that region. I think that the Clark County folks have come a very long way from the day when they voted, hell no, we'll never put light rail in Washington, to now where they actually will accept it. And I think mostly folks feel that it's the right selection of high-capacity transit on that bridge. And so it's a discussion. Conversation in the right economic time probably will help, and something that we hope that they will choose to move along, because we don't think we have a project without it. And so it's something that we're going to continue to work both on both sides of the river and try and get that kind of consensus so that we have support for the entire aspect of the project. And I can't help you with land use. I'm sorry.
It's all right. I don't know if anybody can.
I have Representative Schaffler and then Berger and then Doherty.
I can help him with land use. My good friend here from, a lot of gravel in this project. God bless America. My friend from Milwaukee.
Oh, she's gone. Darn it.
We're familiar in Clackamas County with debate about light rail, and people can get from A to B on this conceptually, and I'm confident they will. I would build the bridge, and I'd have the two rails just sticking out for my neighbors from Vancouver to look at until they decided to say, hey, that's a good idea. But that's what I would do. And by the way, I don't represent anyone in Washington. God bless them. They'll figure it out. I'm worried about what we're doing here, and I appreciate you coming. I also appreciate all the hundreds of other public meetings that you've been to in this conversation, this dialogue. I appreciate all the analysis and studying and consultation, and I'm processed and meeting to death. You know what, folks? I wouldn't have reduced it $650 million. I would have increased it and built more, and I'll tell you why. I just met with the Unemployment Insurance Department today. We're going to have to borrow. We're going to increase the rates to the highest level to replenish our fund. In the meantime, we may have to borrow money, and we have one of the most stable unemployment insurance systems in the country. Mm-hmm. We may have to do a short-term loan to maintain until those funds are replenished. We have our union halls out of work lists growing daily. They're very long, and they're growing. It is criminal to delay, obstruct, and in some people's opinions, deny and prohibit this project from going forward. Every single day that we wait, it's one more day those workers in America aren't providing for their families and paying taxes to educate, medicate, and incarcerate people in this country, in this region. And I'm done. I don't need another public meeting. The next time I see you good people before us, I hope we're talking about how we're going in the project. I don't need another public meeting. And we're not going to get everybody's vote. And not everybody's going to agree. We don't need everyone's agreement, and we don't need everyone's vote. We need to build this bridge and move on. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Representative Schaffler. Representative Berger.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for calling on me after Representative Schaffler.
Luck of the draw.
I have two, if you'll indulge me, very pointed questions, as ditto some of that, maybe not with the same heart, but I am a huge supporter of this project and the jobs that it brings and the freight mobility that it brings and our ability to grow our economy. Don't doubt that. A couple of pointed questions. We talk about the bridges that were built in the 50s and they had a lifespan and it's dead and, you know. What kind of a lifespan are we looking at on this bridge is one question. And the other question, and I don't know who's, you may not have this at your fingertips, so you can get back to me, that's fine. The other is, what are the seismic standards that this will be built to, and why? In other words, who determines what those seismic standards are, and sort of how they play into the cost issues around this? Those are specific things that I need to know.
As the engineer at the table, I'll dive in on the bridge discussion. Typically, we're now estimating that our bridges will last 75 to 100 years. 100 years is really the goal. On the seismic standards, we have, Matt actually mentioned AASHTO. It's the American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials, also very involved in national standard setting for departments of transportation, so that we all don't end up with something different. They've recently just adopted a different seismic standard for areas with liquefaction in the soils, and I'm not exactly sure if this project has been deemed as an area, but they look very carefully and set standards and design the kinds of parameters that bridge engineers will use as we look at different seismic zones, different kinds of soils, and our bridge engineers design to those. So whether or not there's some specific details about the seismic capabilities and the design standards, something that we can certainly get back to you.
Could I have a follow-up so they don't have to come back to me? Okay, so there are standards accepted. It isn't a cost issue so much as it is, these are the standards that you build a bridge to today. And this bridge wouldn't, we always measure, well, what did it cost to make the Markham Bridge safe for 5 more years or 10 more years? This is a different discussion. This is what a bridge today and what its seismic standards are.
For a new bridge.
A new bridge.
Yes.
And that is dictated by a whole bunch of issues around the environment and where it's built and
the kind of soil and the kind
and
of
your engineers your have specific standards.
Is, right.
Okay. Thank you. That answers my question.
Representative. Okay. Thank you. First of all, I appreciate the completeness of this report and the information that you gave, especially on the amount of jobs that will be created in the Portland-Vancouver area and the connectivity to the ports. But my question deals with the toll system, and there are a few of us in this room that do remember when we used to stick our little toll in the interstate bridge. And so my question deals with, have you looked at other similar systems, and what sort of system do they use to keep the traffic moving on a bridge that is a toll bridge?
In Washington State, we have two active toll facilities now. One is the Tacoma Narrows Bridge, which when designed in 2004, opened in 2007, we were still at the place where the technology was not as good as it is today. We have both cash booths and electronic tolling. Well, just this many years forward, we've now moved to 100% electronic tolling capability on our new 520 bridge. We've just advertised for the back office and the toll collection systems, and we'll use a transponder and license plate tag reader kind of a system that you don't have to ever stop. You can capture the license plate or read the tag at 60 miles an hour, and the debit account that you have or a bill will be sent to you in the mail is really an effective way to go. Other places around the country are using these. It's called open road tolling, and it's the way of the future. We have planned for 100% electronic tolling on this project. Saves a lot of real estate when you don't have to have those toll booths on each end of the bridge.
May I have a follow-up question
yes.
on that?
Yes.
And this takes into consideration one-time users,
yes.
two-time users.
Yes, that's the beauty of the license plate reader. And when you move for somebody who comes, say, from Kansas and drives through mm-hmm. just once, the arrangements we have with other state departments of licensing for reciprocity around giving them, getting an address on that license plate is how you capture that. So there's a system that probably will be different even 5 years from now, but for what we see now, it's really advanced a long way in the technology.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Vince.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I want to thank the two directors for taking the time to talk to me about the project. I appreciate your taking that time for someone that's so far from the bridge, we can't even see it on a clear day. having spent the 2 hours this morning listening to a long debate about how the BETSI program investment is challenged, and that's only $200 million. It's welcome news to see you spending all the time you've been spending, as we talk about spending $4 billion. And so to me, sure, there's lots of meetings, but there's lots of money, so I'm happy to see you taking the time you're taking. And I guess that brings me to a question I asked yesterday of Director Brandman, and that is, how much money will this bridge make us? I know you pointed out in your slideshow that it's going to reduce the cost of freight, but and it's going to increase economic development around the bridge. But for those of us 400 miles away in Ontario, the question becomes, what's it going to do for us? Because I see here about $600 million to maybe $1.6 billion will be somehow bungled up by the two states, and I assume that'll be through some sort of broad tax. So why don't you explain to us how this bridge is going to make us money, because I'm sure it is. I support the bridge, and I just want to hear you guys tell us how much money it's going to make us. Kind of like we asked the people this morning about the Betsy, maybe you'd have a better luck.
I'm somewhat reticent to speak before Richard does, because I'm not sure what he told you in the conversation, but let me give it a shot. I think the situation we have right now is we are disadvantaging businesses in the state of Oregon and the state of Washington. Let me just speak to Oregon, and let me eventually get to Eastern Oregon. Again, we know where we are right now, so it's actually costing us money, to be very honest. We are not as efficient with this facility as we can. Again, if we animate this opportunity, I see advantaging businesses, the ability to move freight product from Eastern Oregon. And let me just use maybe a Boardman or a Umatilla, where they're sending ag or minerals or dairy. Again, there's a bottom line cost. A lot of that runs on trucks. Some of it runs on rail, maybe some marine. But again, it all flows into that that I-5 triangle, so to speak. And again, if we can make the facility more functional, I think we are advantaging our businesses in Eastern Oregon and the valley with NORPAC as they move their food products up the I-5. Eventually, it goes to that Portland-Vancouver triangle. If we're down in southern Oregon, Roseburg Forest Products sending their stuff up to the Port of Portland to move out. We are a traded sector economy along the West Coast. And I think when you look at where we are today and how this investment, just from an economic, I won't speak to the other benefits we've already spoken to, but from an economic sense, we remove the disadvantage that we now have placed on our businesses and firms. And I'm sure we will be able to calculate what that means, because I'm sure those good folks in those firms will tell you, sure, this is a bottom line decision for us. We've had to make business decisions and plan for how we get our product to the Portland metro area. And that's costing someone money. I think there's a benefit that will accrue as we animate that project. I hope I was close to what you said. But why don't you share what you said?
I'd be happy
to. Him sit up beside
me. That's right.
Before Matt talked.
Right.
Everything Matt said was correct. I've never heard Matt say anything that wasn't. let me amplify a couple things. One is several years ago in the Portland region, the Port of Portland and the Portland Business Alliance and Metro collaborated on a study called the cost of congestion. And that study was looking at what's the impact on the transportation to the business economy of the transportation system not being fully and basically funded and invested in. And it's the tune of $844 million a year of lost revenue basically to these businesses, or increased cost of doing business. And that's because as the transportation system becomes more congested, it's costing these companies more and more time with their drivers hauling their goods to the market or to the ports, which is costing them even more and more money. Or they have to add more runs because they can't make the run to the airport several times a day in time to catch the flights. And we were informed during that process that there's a real risk to the region of businesses really not wanting to locate in the state because they can't get efficiently in and out of the up and down the I-5 corridor and in and out of those ports. So it's a huge issue, and this project is really in the centerpiece of the economic activity that's going on in the Portland-Vancouver region. So it's a critical project for that for the business community, which is why we have such strong business community support.
Thank you. I don't see any other questions, gentlemen, and I need a very good tag team there for you. And thank you for the information and for coming down and visiting us and sharing with us today. And close the informational hearing on the Columbia River Crossing. And
Madam Chair?
Yeah.
Does the Secretary know we don't have a sales tax in this state? So spend a lot of money.
I am well aware of that. And I'm going to go ahead and open informational hearing on the status of the transportation projects funded by 2001 and ask Doug Tindall to come up.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. Doug Tindall, Deputy Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation, here with some good news, not that you haven't heard good news already, on a very important project, but I'm going to talk about Section 64 of House Bill 2001, which contained a list of projects and funds allocated to those projects. The good news part of this is we didn't wait. If you recall, the funds for those projects come from the increase in gas taxes, which actually doesn't occur until we have two upward economic quarters or January 1st, 2011. When I say we didn't wait, we looked at the cash that we have that's allocated to payments on contracts that will occur after 2011. Or during the after January 1st, 2011. And we concluded that we had enough cash to be able to move forward immediately on the House Bill 2001 projects rather than waiting until the gas tax was enacted and the bonds were sold and so forth. Not totally related to House Bill 2001, but we paid out for work done in July, August, and September of this year, we paid out almost $270 million payments to contractors from the ODOT work that was going on. That's $250 million in 3 months that's going out. This is going to the private sector. This is putting Oregonians to work, and House Bill 2001 was part of that. We have right now there were 37 projects named in the bill. There were 12 political subdivisions that had an allocation of money and that were directed to go to through the area commissions, excuse me, on transportation and to the Transportation Commission to identify projects. That had to be done by July 1st of next year. That's already been done. There are 14 projects that were approved by the commission at the last Oregon Transportation Commission meeting. Those projects, some of which will be able to go to construction in 2010, more in 2011. Sorry, we're supposed to be banned from getting sick during legislative season. I guess this isn't a regular session. So, and it's not H1N1, I'm not running a fever, don't worry. What we have done already, though, is we have three projects in construction already of the projects that were named in the bill, and we have many more that are in design. Attached to your testimony is a chart that shows the projects, the title, a description of the project, the total cost, and the total cost, how much of it was funded by House Bill 2001, and any remaining funds needed to complete the project, and then a plan to get those funds, an estimated completion date, and the current status of the project. Now, this spreadsheet is going to get more, it's going to become nicer and bigger, probably not in the spreadsheet form. We're directed to report quarterly, and the next quarterly report we're working on is a more robust write-up on both the project itself, the benefits of the project, and most importantly, more robust write-up on the status of the project, so that projects that are haven't gone to contract yet, we don't really know for sure what the end date's going to be. Projects where the environmental work is being done, the end date is hard to predict, and even projects in design, it's a little bit difficult if we're working out the details of the design. So, but what we're going to start to report is what's the next milestone that you'll see, so that you can see that we are moving forward on these projects. If we don't know exactly what the project's going to entail, we'll tell you when we think we will know. If we don't know exactly when the design's going to be done, we'll tell you when we think it's going to be done. And so you'll see more robust reporting as we move forward. That's going to be the same information that we make available on the website. In House Bill 2001, there was a requirement to have a website that reported on these projects. And as we've been working on getting a consistent format with the right information in it, when we have that delivered to the legislature, the next step will be to make it available to people on a map of the state, and they can just go click on a project and get all of that same information that you'll see on the quarterly updates. As I said, a number of projects are in design. We'll have more that go to contract in 2010, and then projects that will carry on past that as we finish the environmental work and we finish the design. Had a question this morning about the dates. As you go through the project list, you see dates, some of which are fairly far out into the future. And I'll tell you what I said today, because I think that was an important question. We took a very conservative approach to estimating those end dates, and we did it based on the best information we had today and assuming our traditional project delivery process model, which is what's called design, bid, build. So you design the project, then you bid it out, and you get a construction contractor, and then you build it. There are a couple of different ways to do that. One is called design build, and one is called construction manager general contractor. We've employed both in this state. We're seeing construction manager general contractor on the Willamette River Bridge in Eugene right now. What those allow you to do is actually start some construction before you've completed the design. For instance, on the Willamette River Bridge, we know where the piers are going to go. So we were able to take advantage of last year's in-water work window and start construction on those piers, even though the bridge isn't completely designed yet. So there are ways that we will examine on every one of these projects to speed them up, because we quite clearly understand that direction from the legislature was not only build these projects, but build them as quickly as possible to put people to work. So we are moving forward as quickly as we can on the projects in House Bill 2001, and with that, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
I have a quick question. I don't know. Maybe I should take it offline. But the legislature that wrote the bill and designated the project and kind of put you in a position where, you know, you're going to do this. I have received an email from a local mayor who was raising a few concerns about unfunded, you know, that we've got projects identified and funding on the state part, but that there's still not total funding on some of them, and getting stuck with that. And I don't know if that's something that you're hearing a lot of.
Chair Byer, not a lot. There are some projects where there are a lot of demands on what people would like to do on the overall project, and I think the discussion becomes one of phasing. So we'll take the money that was allocated by the legislature and say, what can we do for this amount of money? How can we make sure that fits into a larger long-term plan? Then the funding comes from wherever it comes from, the federal government, the state government, or the local governments, or private donation. I don't know, but we will use the money that the legislature gave us to do what we can.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you share with us the cost of bonding and the thinking that you're doing in trying to lock in what now appear to be really low rates. Is this one of those things you take into account, or do you wait until the projects are ready and then go do your bonding at that time?
Chair Beyer, Representative Bentz, we can't bond until we have that revenue stream in place. So we can't sell bonds until 2011 or whenever the gas tax goes in place. Beyond that, there is a term in bonding called arbitrage, and you can't just sell all the bonds at once and then sit on the money. What we do is we try and maximize the benefits of low interest rates, but in a way that's realistic by how quickly we think things are going to pay out. So in terms of the $840 million worth of bonds that we will sell under this program, we will sell them in spurts. Probably we never normally sell bonds in the spring. So we'll sell bonds each year in the spring to cover our cash flow for that year. Or, as we've done on OTIA, we'll sell them every other year. So we sell a little bit bigger, if the market conditions are favorable, a little bit bigger bond sale, cash lasts a little bit longer to pay out. So we do try and maximize that, but we do have some limits on what we can do.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. No other questions on that one, so you can go ahead. I'll close the informational hearing on that transportation projects and go to the practical design.
Madam Chair, just for the record, I remain Doug Tindall, Deputy Director of Highways for ODOT. Practical design, another aspect of House Bill 2001, and one that's really exciting for us in ODOT. And what this has allowed us to do, incorporating the flexibility in the applications of standards and reducing the cost of project delivery while still preserving and enhancing safety. I think that was actually in the bill. And what practical design has allowed us to do is to pull together a number of things that we have done over the course of the past several years, learn from other states what they're doing, and start to modify our practices. Basically, the concept of practical design, as we're applying it, maximizes the benefit on the entirety of the system. The traditional method of design would have said for any given project, you do everything you can to maximize the benefit for that project. That, what that does is, or can do, is drive up the cost of the project such that those last bits of benefit that you're gaining are coming at a fairly high cost. So if we can get, for instance, 90% of the benefit for 75% of the cost or 50% of the cost on a project, practical design would say that's what you should do. And then you should take the money that you didn't spend on that project and spend it on another project where you can generate, again, not 100% of the benefits, but maybe 80, 90% of the benefits on another project. And together, you've taken your set amount of money, you've done two projects, neither generates 100% of what you could have done on either of those projects, but in total, you've generated more benefit. And that's the basic philosophy that we're trying to get across, is to not think in just a project-by-project basis, but to think more holistically across the entire system. We've phrased it as, or I've heard this phrase, as letting engineers engineer. Sometimes if you rigorously apply standards, you're sort of trapped as an engineer, you're sort of trapped into a decision. But by looking at those standards and what you're trying to accomplish from those standards and saying, I can accomplish this, I can accomplish the same outcome or nearly the same outcome, and do it in a little bit less expensive way, that's what practical engineering is about. I want to assure you that we will never compromise safety. We will not use practical design as a way to say we're going to make something less safe than it is today. Everything we do will be as safe as it is or safer than it is today. And that is the one tenet which we will not vary from as we implement practical design. We have some examples that we've been able to use practical design concepts already. And I'll talk about one that we've done on the stimulus package. What we did, working with the FHWA, And the FHWA is key to us because a lot of the standards are apply to federal aid highways, and so we have to have FHWA's agreement on what we're doing, and they are on board with this concept. And an example of that was on the stimulus projects, where you would normally, if you were going to do a overlay, a pavement overlay, you would normally go in and say, okay, within the bounds of that area that you're going to do the overlay in, are there anything that, any features that are substandard? Is the guardrail substandard or the sign substandard and so forth? And what the working with the FHWA, what we did to stretch the stimulus dollars is we said, if there's guardrail out there that's not standard, but it hasn't been hit in 20 years, why should we spend money to bring it up to standard? And similarly with signs, if they're still readable but don't exactly meet the standard, why would we spend the money? And they so there were places where we just paved. We didn't do anything else. Conversely, there were areas where you're in a section of roadway where the guardrail has been hit a lot of times. We're going to fix that because we're going to make that safer. The trade-off, or no, it really wasn't a trade-off, it, by doing that, by applying that philosophy and just paving on some of those projects where you really needed pavement, we were able to put money into safety projects where we're not doing pavement. And one of those is just starting just south of town on I-5, where we're going to replace that median barrier that is not a good safety solution right now. So that is an example of the kind of thing, the holistic system thinking that you get when you apply practical design comments. When you apply practical design. So there's some other word there, and it's somewhere out in the ether. To date, we've had that example where we've already used that on the stimulus packages. FHWA actually facilitated a peer exchange. Three other states came out to Oregon. One other state participated by phone. And we talked about how practical design, or the basic concept of practical design, was applied in their state. And we shared with them what we had done. And so there was good learning both directions. One thing we found out is you can't just simply apply, values in different states are different, and you can't simply apply what one state's doing directly into Oregon. For instance, in Missouri, one of the things that they do through their application of practical design is they don't use paved shoulders. They have gravel shoulders. Well, that doesn't work in a bicycle-friendly environment like we have in Oregon. They don't have, I asked that question, and they said, well, that's not really an issue for them. Bicycles is not an issue in Missouri. But it is in Oregon. So we will apply that differently. Now, we'll do things different. We'll look at the design of the shoulder and make sure we're doing that in the most cost-effective way, but we're not going to do exactly what Missouri's doing. So it's going to be tailored to Oregon, so it fits in Oregon. And we're going to apply this. We've done some work with our project delivery, our internal folks in project delivery, and to make sure that we implement this in the best way possible. And on the last page of the testimony is a kind of a timeline about what we've done so far and where we're going to implement this. Again, in some ways we've already started. In other ways, it's a continuation of a continual improvement. We're at a point now where we've almost got a strategy that works within ODOT. We're going to vet that strategy with external partners, make sure we didn't miss something, or make sure there's not an opportunity that we haven't taken advantage of. And then we'll move ahead with implementing practical design and the required legislative report that occurs late next year. So good news story. Practical design can work. I think we've shown it already is working, and I think it will continue to work in Oregon. And with that, I'd be glad to answer any questions about practical design.
Just a real quick one, I guess, for me, in that since really you're doing a lot of this anyway, do you really think it's going to be a dramatic change? Or
Chair Beyer, I'm not a revolutionist. I'm an incrementalist. And I don't think that there's a light switch that comes on and you all of a sudden see this huge change, particularly in large organizations. I think that if we look back 5 years from now, at the way we used to look at a project on a project-by-project basis and not look holistically across the system, I think you'll see a significant difference. And I think it'll be a better result. But will there be a huge party and celebration and champagne and everything because we did something right? No. It will take time, but it will. It is not just window dressing. This is a meaningful change in the way that we think about projects, and over time it will save us a lot of money.
Thank you. I don't see any other questions, so thank you for coming. Thanks. And go take care of yourself.
All right.
Close the informational hearing on practical design and open a public hearing on high-speed rail funding, and I'll just go ahead and open the rail transportation report at the same time, so...
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kelly Taylor with the Rail Division, and with me today is Betsy Eimholt, who's also been working with the Rail Division. And we're going to talk about the two subjects you just mentioned. One is an update on where we are with the high-speed passenger rail federal funding and the state rail transportation report. And I think everyone knows that in the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, known as ARRA, got to have an acronym, that there was an unprecedented amount of federal funding that came forth for passenger rail, specifically higher speed rail. And I think it's important to say that because people say the word high speed rail and it conjures up, we talked about this on the Senate side this morning, all kinds of different thoughts in people's heads from, you know, is it, you know, like in France where it's several hundred miles an hour? Is it a bullet train? What is it? What Congress was talking about when they designated federal, the 10 corridors, and we have one between Eugene and Vancouver, BC, was incrementally to 110 miles an hour. Now, there was emerging higher speed rail than that, 125 and some others, but it really takes a certain combination of distance and populations, et cetera, to make that be what you should do. And frankly, in our valley, between Eugene, Portland, Seattle, higher speed rail is what we're talking about, not bullet trains, okay? Now, interestingly enough, when this $8 billion, which is unprecedented, like I said, we've all been waiting for Amtrak to just wither away because that's what's been happening through all the budget cuts through the years, but here it is, 2 months into his first term, President Obama in ARRA allocates $8 billion and says this is a jump start, that he wants to pledge $1 billion for each of the next 5 years. And already in different packages, the congressional leaders and President Obama have had different ideas up to $50 billion allocated maybe over the next several years towards passenger rail. So clearly, there's a lot of interest in passenger rail, higher speed passenger rail. And the Federal Railroad Administration is the part of USDOT that's been given this responsibility for this $8 billion and the ongoing program. And they've stressed repeatedly through the different workshops that that it's intended to be an ongoing program. And what they're looking for is real tangible benefits to either the infrastructure, equipment, the performance of the system, perhaps some intermodal connections, not only just for the short term, but projects to be in the pipeline as this program continues and funding continues. There were, I just mentioned, there are 10 federally designated corridors. Now, those are not the only corridors that are eligible, but clearly those are the ones that already have usually some activity on them. Our corridor that runs between Eugene, Portland, Seattle, and Vancouver, BC, has been around for 10 years with active service that has been growing every single year. And we have currently, Oregon pays for the two trains that run between Eugene and Portland. And then Washington has got two trains that run between Portland, Seattle, and two trains that run between Seattle and Vancouver, BC. And this is daily. Then there's also Amtrak's long-distance train, the Coast Starlight, that runs between Los Angeles and Seattle daily. So we've been growing the business, as you would say, and I believe that competition is going to be fierce. It has been fierce. I'm going to talk about that in a minute. But I do think that we have a good story to tell, and I do think we will be competitive. They've stressed repeatedly, I'm going to talk about these two rounds, that it's not just this round. There will be future rounds. And so obviously, and you're going to hear this, there's always more want than there is money to go around. Isn't that interesting how that always works out?
Really?
I'm not a math whiz, but I have figured that part out. There were two rounds of applications. There was an application round that was due in August. And basically, that's a two-year window for the project to get done. And they're really looking for projects that were ready for construction. Perhaps the preliminary engineering, the PE, and the environmental, the NEPA work, was already done. And people were looking for construction dollars. I think that's what they really were looking for when they said this is a two-year frame that this work should be done. And then in October, there was a round that it was a five-year window. What Oregon did, and we worked very closely with our Rail Advisory Committee in reviewing projects that we should submit, our partners in Washington, and the affected railroads, because you needed to have their agreement that they would support those projects. You have to remember, it's a privately owned infrastructure for the most part, and you're running the passenger trains on them. It's a freight system that you're running passenger trains on. So you have to get their buy-in and agreement that if you got this money, they would do the work and help make those improvements. And we succeeded in securing those agreements with those railroads, both the Union Pacific, the Burlington Northern, and the Portland and Western, because all three of those railroads get affected. In our applications, they totaled $2.3 billion. It was about 10 projects of congestion-related type projects. And these are, we got talking about this today, this morning, too. It's a passenger rail program, but these really are freight projects because you're running it on the freight system. So if you can put improvements to the freight system, it trickles down and benefits the passenger rail system. At least that's what you're looking for. Not all projects would, but we look for projects that would do both. And we applied for those same projects. Most of them are in the Portland area. They're projects that have been identified in past studies about congestion. And we actually are proportionally twice as congested as the Chicago area. We don't have as much traffic, but if you were to multiply it out proportionally, we have more congestion than the Chicago area, which is very well known for its congestion for rail traffic. So we have projects in the Portland area, a project in the Eugene area, and then Betsy's going to touch on this when she talks about the study. We have one that looks at where best to do an analysis, to do the environmental analysis, et cetera, where best to run the passenger trains. Is it to stay on the Union Pacific line or to move on the Oregon Electric line or some combination thereof? And I'm going to let her talk about that in more detail. We applied in the August round, the two-year round, for just PE and NEPA for these projects because, again, you only have 2 years to get it done. We applied under the five-year window, the October one, for the same projects for PE, NEPA, and construction. So we put eggs in both baskets to see what we would come up with. The Federal Railroad Administration has had their hands full. They are not like aviation, transit, and highway that has had ongoing money programs for many, many years. This is the first time they've ever had this. They have a loan program, but they've never had this before. So, and they did not get extra staff. So they've really been working hard to put a program in place and applications, et cetera. I know what it's like because we did it with Connect Oregon. This is much larger. It takes some doing. And they have said at first they were going to award off the first round and then the second round. They've got 26 states that applied for $57 billion. And the applications are very, very large. I talked to one state and they said theirs was over 3,400 pages. Ours, if you were to go from the ground up, reaches my knee. And I'm fairly tall, so it's, you know, it's quite a bit of paper. Now, what we did was we did them electronically, but that's what it all equals. They were very, very comprehensive applications you had to put in. So they've said to us and to the other states, they originally said that they thought they would have the applications sorted through and decided upon in 45 days. And then it became fall, and then they said, well, it'll be in the fall, and then they said winter. And what we're hearing is, I think it is winter, and it'll probably be, from the last rumor I heard, somewhere between January 1 and February 15th, which would pretty much coincide with the anniversary of the package to begin with, so I think that's what they're shooting for. But they have their work cut out for them. It's not easy to go through all of that and to try to do it. So, and they do have some help, I think, with some consultant work, but, I mean, it's a lot of stuff to go through. So we have our fingers crossed. They have told states, we know the competition's fierce, not everyone's not going to get something in the first round. This is an ongoing program. You will have a chance to see what you could have done better or maybe where you didn't compete as well or something like that and come back at it. I do not believe this will be our first round at all. Again, like I said, both Congress and the President have been already talking in different packages, legislations back there of what to do for more money towards this. So we'll see. I remain very hopeful. I think we have a good story to tell. I think our corridor is well-respected. It is the seventh heaviest traffic corridor in the country, and given that we don't have the population base some of those do, I think that tells a pretty good story. We really have been growing ridership. So with that, I will stop, and I'd like, Betsy, if you don't mind, go ahead and cover the study, and then we'll see what we've got for questions on both.
Okay. Go ahead. Hi, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Betsy Eimholt with the ODOT Rail Division. In 2007, the legislature authorized a statewide rail study, which we are in the middle of combing through the data right now to produce the study for you after the first of the year. It's been underway for about 18 months. The study is very comprehensive, and it looks at both freight and passenger-related issues, and as you know, this is mostly a privately owned network, yet it's vitally important to the state's economic health. So it's a bit, in some ways, uncharted territory because we were looking for, you know, bridge conditions, and that's not something that we normally look at or have on record for railroads. On the passenger side of the assessment, we looked at both commuter rail extending the west to Salem in particular, which we were doing, and then in the meanwhile, last session, the legislature expressed interest in doing that, and so that will be included, as well as a look at the inner city passenger rail, which is Amtrak, in Oregon, and where those trains should run. Now, if there's a map on the back of your testimony that has the yellow background that looks like this, and this really kind of sums up the reason why we looked at this issue. The Amtrak trains today run on the orange line.
Oh, no.
Which here in Salem is on 12th Street, just right out here, I think. And that's a very busy freight line, and that's good. We like freight traffic to be busy. There's 20 to 25 trains a day on that line, and then our passenger trains are on there as well. Our passenger trains historically have been about 60% on time, and although this line is classified to go to 79 miles an hour, there's only 6 miles an hour where our trains actually do that. The trip time from Portland to Eugene is 2 hours and 35 minutes. It's an average speed of 40-something miles per hour. As we want to grow service, as the population grows, and we would like to decrease that trip time, and we would like to increase the on-time performance, the question is what do you have to do that? And there's really two options as we've looked at it. One is, what does it take to beef up that orange line where we are now to get you that capacity? And the other is to maybe relocate the trains. And the blue line, which you see there, is commonly referred to as the Oregon Electric Line. It's been around for 100 years, and as you can see, there's only 2 to 6 trains a day on that line. So it's less dense. This line in Salem, for example, just to give you a frame of reference, runs along Front Street. So that's where the two lines are in Salem. Now, that's not without its challenges, and it's certainly not a slam dunk that we're ready to say, let's go do it. But it is something that the study looks at in a fairly robust way, and we like to do more work on that, frankly. One of the projects that we applied for with the stimulus dollars was the money to do a full-blown environmental impact statement on this question, on where to move these, and that would include all of the normal studies that a project like this would entail, including noise and vibration and all of those technical studies that would have to go on. Both lines have opportunities and challenges, and some of the situations are pretty meaty issues, but we would like to look more at it. Again, no decision has been made. Also in this study, we look at, on the freight side, what do we have, how's it being used, looking in the crystal ball of commodity flows in the future, where do we think the rail world is headed, and what are the pitfalls of that, and what are the risks, and what are the opportunities? And this is where really the majority of the study will focus. And just to give you a little preview, of the track miles that exist in Oregon, over half are short line. On those short lines, many of them have one train a week. So you're looking at a dedicated highway that's empty 6 days out of 7. And the short line network is only shipping 15% of the freight in all of Oregon. on the rail freight. The rest is all on the Class 1 railroads. So we are busy combing through all the data to try to pull out and weave this story together about really where the opportunities are, what this means, and especially in the Willamette Valley that really does have a robust short line infrastructure in place. How can we, what changes need to be made, and what policies could the state do to encourage its more robust use in the future? So the study is expected to be done after the first of the year, and we'll love to come back and talk to you about it when we're ready to present all the results and findings. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? Go ahead. Oh, okay. Representative Schaffner.
Those communities count on that one train a week, though. Okay. So I was going to write to George here. on the Amtrak stuff, and this is related to the Olympics, are they booked up, those trains? Are people reserving passage to the Olympics on the trains? Do you keep that data? You know what that is?
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, I know that they have added a second train. That's why there's now two trains between Seattle and Vancouver, B.C. I am not familiar off the top of my head with what the passenger booking is, how it's going. I will find out, and I'll let you know.
And thank you, if I may. I would like to find out what it is from Oregon to Vancouver, B.C.
Madam Chair and Representative Schaffler, I will see what I can find for that statistics for you.
Thank you.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to talk a little bit about the Oregon Electric Line. As you know, that goes through the town where I live, Milwaukee. And so there's been some concern expressed about that we're going to be getting a light rail line right close to where the electric line goes. So talk some about the process and mitigation, et cetera. What would happen? And is that the best route that you're looking at for the possibility of fast rail from Eugene to Portland?
The alignment in Milwaukee, Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, in particular, our engineers have sat down with the TriMet engineers because it does share a corridor for about a mile if we were to go on this alignment, on the switch alignments. And the engineers have laid it out pretty clearly that there really aren't any conflicts about co-locating, and that would include two higher speed heavy rail tracks, which would probably in this corridor, I mean, it's not anything in the triple digits, I'll tell you that, and a safety wall in between, and then two light rail tracks, and that can coexist in the existing right-of-way that is there. And that's something that we've had informal meetings about to try to get a handle on how big of a challenge would that be. And it doesn't appear to be a horrible challenge. I think there's more difficult ones than that. What else?
Mitigation.
Yeah, I think the one of the huge challenges on that project, and frankly it's the same with the UP too, because if we stayed there, then we're going to have to expand that facility. So all of, we have met with every community along the alignment, some more than once, and we will continue to do that, and we expect that the EIS process would be one heavy on public involvement. And I think that's one of the questions that each community has to engage in is either option, whether you're Cambie and you're on the UP or you're Milwaukee, where frankly it has both lines through it, is what do those options look like and what would need to happen for it to be a win-win? Because it is an opportunity to take care of some other issues, like maybe we separate a crossing, or you know, maybe there's some other something that needs to happen that would be something that the community would want anyway, and this is an opportunity to do it. And I think we're very open to all those conversations.
Follow-up?
Yes,
follow-up. So have you had meetings yet in Milwaukee?
We met, Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, we met along with Director Garrett with members of Milwaukee, Lake Oswego, Tualatin, Wilsonville, basically a southern metro group, and there was mayors and city councilors and planners there. And then I've spoken with Milwaukee several times on the phone with the planners there myself. And then I've also met with the Clackamas County planners in a separate meeting that they have on a regular basis. So we are starting that effort. In addition, the folks out of the National Policy Consensus Center, which is a group out of PSU, sometimes they're called Oregon Solutions, depending on what the project is, they've been under contract with us at the request of the governor to go out and have these one-on-ones with the communities, and they've done that all the way up and down the line as well.
Terrific. And would you keep me on whatever lists you have about these meetings. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm very happy that the director of Washington Transportation left, because it happens that the folks in Washington are able to take water out of the Columbia River and grow onions 2 hours closer to, 3 or 4 hours closer to the West Coast than those onion growers in Ontario. And thus, the freight of moving the onions to the coast is far less expensive. So it happens that the onions grown in the Treasure Valley go to New York, because we're closer to New York than is Tri-Cities. One of the solutions to the problem might be rail, and I say might be because still got to get onions to the West Coast by rail. So I've been extremely interested in knowing how you guys in your studies are looking at the eastern part of the state. And also, I'm interested in how you coordinate between trucks and rail, because I know that Rena Kuzma of ODOT is working on a transportation issue, these very issues. So are you guys working together like this? And also, what's the solution ultimately going to be? Because as I talk to onion farmers and other folks that would love to move stuff to the West Coast, they stall out on that distance issue. Is there a solution, or is this just hopeless?
I don't think we've found a solution yet.
Madam Chair and Representative Bentz, this is the very issue that we are concentrating on in the freight part of the study. And in particular, we know that there are certain movements that the Class 1s in particular take that really go through Oregon but don't terminate at the Port of Portland, but they don't necessarily stop along the way. And that's a big issue we know with the grain growers in Eastern Oregon in particular. So one of the questions is, how do commodities such as grain in Eastern Oregon get rail service access? Now, unfortunately, we know that with the Class 1 service, we don't have the ability legally to make them stop and pick up these carloads. It's just not something that is within our authority. But so that's one of the strategic questions is, how can we create opportunities so that the railroads will want to pick them up, and whether this is Class 1s or whether it's even the short lines can have the same problem, because if they only have a couple carloads, it doesn't mean they can get eventually it's got to get to the Class 1s to continue on. So maybe there's opportunities to aggregate carloads, and maybe that's a way through Connect Oregon or whatever, where we can facilitate through state policy and goals to have some of these investments made that could really give access to, we know that the rail companies want more customers, and we know that there are customers out there, but it's a matter of matching them up so that it makes sense for everyone. That is the challenge, and our study will definitely get into that.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, may I just add something? Representative Bentz, I just wanted to tell you that yesterday we had a workshop with our consultant team, and they were briefing me on what they had just been learning recently, and they had a map of Oregon split into different regions, and they had it color-coded, and it got darker in color with volume, and they were tracking intrastate movement, whether it be truck or rail. And what was interesting was the short lines do have the ability to do more of the intra-Oregon, because as Betsy was just saying, the Class 1s, Union Pacific and Burlington Northern, are interested in the bigger long hauls. It was interesting to see that in Oregon, the two heaviest shaded areas of exchanging business on truck is Valley and Eastern Oregon. And so what we need to do is look at where we can put, as she was saying, those hubs, those collector points that may be on a short line to collect up it and try to move it from one side to the other so that we can get the movement going, like you're saying, back and forth. Either with or without Class 1s, depending on where you can be. And we're looking at where there are connections of short line and preferably both Class 1s so that you have the competitive access. And, in fact, there are several of those sites in the state. And then there are sites of Class 1 and short line. And since the short lines represent over 50% of our track miles and obviously are only currently handling 15%, that's where you have a chance at boosting some capacity if you can structure it strategically, and that's the whole point of doing the study. So I believe we're going to come up, I believe from what I saw yesterday, we are having some aha moments and just need to figure out how we do that. And when we do that, it's not a matter of trading truck over rail. It's a matter of doing it in a different sort of combination and doing some intermodal movements that we don't do today, because right now the only intermodal movements are happening is in Portland. It's the only spot that we have for intermodal. And we could relieve some congestion on the road and yet still move it by rail and then do truck locally differently than we're doing it today. That's the opportunity I think we're going to see.
Representative Shoffler.
Thank you. I think we ought to go up and share our positive, beneficial experiences with light rail with people in Vancouver and get those nice people up in Washington that get to pull water out of the Columbia, come down here and share their positive and beneficial experiences with doing that, because I think we have something to learn from that, Representative. But and this rail car issue is a huge. It's all across the Midwest, Canada. In this economy, there are thousands of rail cars and engines just sitting there.
Yes.
Has that helped the large train railroad companies be a little more? And I think they all left. I think all the representatives from the railroads left. Has that helped them be more inclined to work at this level of picking up? You know, be more willing to pick up smaller numbers of cars, or not?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Shoffler, I think that the reason you see everything parked is because the business is down so much. And
I hear the train. That's somebody making money and working, by the way.
Don't
bother me that
I'm with
much.
You. I want to see more trains out there, too, because I think it's a way to move the heavier loads and to move the hazardous material much safer and much less costly than doing it on our roads. I think that there have been some changes in business just to keep going. And what we have learned, because one of the things we're doing is looking at different scenarios and what it means, like the Class 1 business models of the larger trains and then how you mitigate that so that you stay in the game. I believe, yes, there is some change right now. I don't know that it will hold on when business rebounds, because they do have capacity constraints. That's my whole point. They do have capacity constraints when business is up, but the short lines don't. That's why we need to look at investing in the short line structure to keep things moving inside of Oregon, because that's what's not moving by rail. Things are moving out of the state by rail, but things aren't moving around in the state by rail. I heard Senator George this morning talk about he takes his product and trucks it to Vancouver, BC, so he can put it on rail. I really don't want to do that. I really would think we could find a way to put it on rail somewhere in Oregon. So it's not without its challenges, but I think we'll get there. And I think that what we also have learned is inside of recession, we've looked at in the recession what happens to the two. The Class 1s are able to do cost-cutting efficiencies and stuff easier than the short lines. We've got some short lines that I, quite frankly, am very worried may not make it. It's serious. They have a hard enough time. They have infrastructure needs and things that are beyond their budget. They only have 15% of the business. And yet, frankly, they are a huge part of our circulatory system as far as the rail goes. We have got to have short lines. Not everything's going to go by a Class 1. Not everything's along the gorge or on I-5. We have got to have the short lines.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, last one, and I know it's getting late, but if we took more greater advantage of our abundant forests, would some of those short lines be helped out?
Just say yes.
That's what I want to hear.
Forest products are what are the main business for the short lines. There's no doubt about it.
Well, if we want people to go back to work, Madam Chair, we're going to have to get real around here.
But I do think, Madam Chair, that we're finding some pretty interesting things. I'm excited about it. I think there'll be some things in the report that people go, oh, dang, that wasn't what I was hoping to hear. I was hoping to hear something else. But that's okay. We've really been doing a good scrub. I'm very, very pleased with what I've been seeing and hearing. And I'm glad we've had the opportunity to do it. I thank you for giving us the funds so we could do the study. I really think it's going to make a difference.
And at the risk of angering anybody, who are you talking to in this study? Who are you consulting with, or who are the...
Pins.
Madam Chair, are you talking about who's the audience, or who are we getting your information
from? Who are we talking to?
Well, it depends on what the task was, but it all involved a lot of outreach with whoever knows the information. So the railroads are heavily involved on both the passenger and the freight side, and shippers, too. So all that. And on the passenger side, transit agencies.
On that, Madam Chair, if I may.
Yes.
And you're also dealing with people that ship commodities and stuff like that to the growers and
interviews.
Wood fiber industry,
yes.
All those folks too.
Good.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. thank everybody for coming today, and thank you. I hope you had a good trip to China.
I had a fabulous time. I suggest everyone go see that country. It's very, very interesting. I rode maglev train and I rode a bullet train.
Uh-huh.
You ride the one in Tianjin to Beijing?
We are adjourned, yes.